From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
En la situación específica de Cuba, debido a los planes del imperio,
in Cuba's specific situation, because of the plans of the empire, my health becomes a state secret, which cannot be divulged carelessly, and our compatriots should understand this.
No puedo caer en el círculo vicioso de los parámetros de salud.
I cannot fall in the vicious circle of fulfilling health parameters that change constantly. I can say that I am in stable medical condition, but recovery takes time.
Necesita el transcurso.
A Cuban government spokesperson reading the words of Fidel Castro. The Cuban president has temporarily handed power over to his brother Raul until he recovers from an operation. Today, an exclusive interview with Ricardo Alarcón. The head of the Cuban National Assembly has often been mentioned as Castro's heir apparent. And we'll speak with Leonard Weinglass, an attorney for the Cuban Five.
Five Cuban men who came to the United States to monitor the activities of terrorist groups in Miami, whose convictions were overturned on appeal, remain in prison, despite the fact that a court had ruled they never received a fair trial.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel sent as many as 18,000 troops into Lebanon as part of a massive ground invasion. An Israeli military official told the Washington Post the number of troops could soon triple. The ground assault comes as Israel continues to bomb areas around South Lebanon. A Lebanese official said Israel's carrying out an unprecedented air attack on the ancient city of Baalbek. The assault began late Tuesday, 3 hours before the end of Israel's announced two-day pause to the bombing. At least 12 civilians were killed in an Israeli airstrike in a nearby village. Five family members were found dead in their collapsed home. Witnesses said Israel bombed Baalbek's main hospital, which was already filled with wounded patients. The raid of Baalbek marked Israel's deepest known incursion into Lebanon in 12 years, when Israeli forces abducted a Lebanese militant leader. It later released in a prisoner exchange. Meanwhile, three Israeli soldiers and an unknown number of Hezbollah fighters were killed in clashes near the Israel-Lebanon border. Hezbollah launched more than 60 missiles into Israel today, after firing just eight Tuesday. An Israeli man was killed when a rocket struck close to the Israeli town of Nahariya. Meanwhile, a Hezbollah rocket landed in an open area near an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. It was the furthest Hezbollah had fired since fighting began last month. Tens of thousands of Lebanese refugees are expected to once again be displaced as the Israeli bombing intensifies. This is International Red Cross spokesperson Roland Huguenin.
More than 2 weeks, the ICRC has been assisting civilian Lebanese in their villages in the south. They were living in shelters under the shelling. Today, some of them decided to move north. The ICRC will go on helping them in the shelters in the south and will set up an operation of relief for those who made the decision to go up north.
Many Lebanese villages have yet to receive desperately needed aid. A UN spokesperson said Israel's tightened restrictions on the travel of relief convoys. Meanwhile, aid workers are also warning Lebanon is close to running out of fuel. Officials say there may be only 2 or 3 days' supply left. And demonstrations continue around the world over the Israeli strike on Khana that killed nearly 60 civilians. Hundreds of Palestinians marched in Gaza and Ramallah. In Jerusalem, protesters gathered outside the American consulate to protest U.S. support for the war. Humanitarian aid's begun to reach Khana in the aftermath of the attack. One resident said the town was not looking for aid, but for an end to the fighting.
The supplies only arrived today, but we don't want aid. What we saw here 2 days ago was the biggest proof of massacres being committed. 37 children were killed in one massacre. 57 people were dead. These aid supplies will not help. We want everyone to unite and take a position on a ceasefire.
The U.S. and Israeli governments insist the fighting will continue. On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said the assault could continue for weeks. Olmert said Israel would be ready for a ceasefire only when an international force is deployed to South Lebanon. His comments come as the European Union adopts a statement calling for a cessation of hostilities, but stops short of calling for an immediate ceasefire. Meanwhile, former President Jimmy Carter has weighed in on the war in Lebanon, writing in the Washington Post. President Carter said, quote, "It's inarguable that Israel has a right to defend itself against attacks on its civilians, but it is inhumane and counterproductive to punish civilian populations in the illogical hope that somehow they will blame Hamas and Hezbollah for provoking the devastating response." Carter went on to write, quote, "There will be no substantive and permanent peace for any peoples in this troubled region as long as Israel is occupying Arab lands and oppressing the Palestinians. A major impediment to progress is Washington's strange policy that dialogue on controversial issues will be extended only as a reward for subservient behavior and will be withheld from those who reject U.S. assertions." In Cuba, President Fidel Castro released a statement Tuesday assuring Cubans his condition is stable. A government spokesperson read out Castro's remarks.
"I would not make up good news because it would not be ethical. And if the news was bad, the only one who would benefit would be the enemy." "In Cuba's specific situation, because of the plans of the empire, my health becomes a state secret, which cannot be divulged carelessly, and our compatriots should understand this. I cannot fall in the vicious circle of fulfilling health parameters that change constantly. I can say that I am in stable medical condition, but recovery takes time."
Meanwhile, in Miami, hundreds of Cuban Americans took to the streets Tuesday to celebrate the news of Castro's poor health. Miami's home to around 650,000 Cuban exiles. In Havana, thousands of people took part in rallies honoring Castro. This is Havana resident Pedro Torres.
"We Cubans are here for no other reason than to support Fidel. We are the right arm, he is the left. We are the body of him, the soul of him is us. We are going forward, we are prepared for anything, for whatever he tells us."
After headlines, we'll be speaking with the president of the National Assembly, Ricardo Alarcón, who's just been speaking with Fidel Castro. In military news, a high-ranking officer admitted Tuesday more than two-thirds of the Army National Guard's 34 brigades are not ready for combat. Lieutenant General Stephen Blum, the top general of the National Guard, said the Army's suffering a major shortfall in equipment. In Iraq, more than 70 people died in violence around the country Tuesday. The deadliest attack claimed the lives of at least 23 Iraqi soldiers on a bus traveling to Baghdad. ABC News is reporting the military is investigating the commanding officer of four U.S. soldiers who've been charged with murdering three Iraqi civilians. The soldiers have admitted to the killings, but have claimed they were only following orders to kill all military-age males. In this new development, the soldier's commanding officer, Colonel Michael Steele, is being investigated for inciting his troops to go on a killing spree. Colonel Steele has had a celebrated military career. He was portrayed in the 2001 Hollywood film Black Hawk Down, about a U.S. military unit fighting in Somalia in 1993. Sources told ABC News soldiers in Colonel Steele's unit believe they had been ordered to shoot all Iraqi men. Colonel Steele apparently kept a, quote, kill board, counting the number of Iraqis killed under his command, and gave out commemorative knives to soldiers who killed Iraqis believed to be insurgents. In other Iraq news, Democratic Senator Max Baucus of Montana has announced the death of his nephew serving in Iraq. Corporal Philip Baucus died on Saturday while serving in Anbar province. His uncle initially voted to authorize the Iraq war, but earlier this year backed a Democratic measure calling for a phased redeployment of U.S. troops by year's end. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, an opposition presidential candidate is alleging massive fraud in Sunday's national elections. Azarias Ruberwa, who leads the Congolese Rally for Democracy, said irregularities were so widespread his party may challenge the final vote. Final results are expected later this month. Back in the United States, the New York Times is reporting union leaders representing thousands of scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency are accusing agency heads of bowing to political pressure and allowing harmful chemicals in agricultural pesticides. The call comes ahead of a deadline Thursday for Congress to approve thousands of chemicals the scientists say pose serious risks for fetuses, pregnant women, young children, and the elderly. In a new disclosed letter sent in May, union leaders representing 9,000 scientists said EPA is ignoring principles of sound science and putting the concerns of the agriculture and pesticide industry before the health of U.S. citizens. In some cases, the EPA has allegedly ignored independent scientific studies that contradict those sponsored by the pesticide industry. An EPA specialist involved in the pesticide program told the New York Times, quote, "The pesticide program functions as a governmental cover for what is effectively a private industry licensing program." In other news, a new Senate report is raising alarm bells over the use of offshore tax havens for wealthy Americans. The cheating accounts for up to $70 billion per year. That's 7 cents out of each dollar paid by regular taxpayers. Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin, who headed the investigation, said, quote, "Offshore tax cheating has become so large that no one, not even the United States government, could go after all of it." In other news, the U.S. government has won an appeal to obtain the phone records of two New York Times reporters over a story on the government's investigation of Islamic charities before the 9/11 attacks. Prosecutors are investigating how former New York Times reporter Judith Miller and her colleague, Philip Shinnin, learned of government plans to search the premises of two Islamic charities. On Tuesday, a federal court overturned a previous ruling that said the New York Times was protected by a reporter's privilege under the First Amendment of the Constitution. And finally, Sunil Kumar, a survivor and leading campaigner for victims of the 1984 Bhopal chemical gas leak, has died of an apparent suicide. Kumar founded the group Children Against Carbide, which attempted to bring the company Union Carbide, now owned by Dow Chemical, to justice. He was found dead last week wearing a T-shirt that read, "No more Bhopals." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
On Monday night, 79-year-old Cuban President Fidel Castro temporarily handed over power to his brother Raul. This marks the first time since he became president in 1959 that Castro ceded power. The Cuban president was forced to undergo surgery to repair an ailment that's caused intestinal bleeding. In a speech read by an aide on Cuban television Monday night, Castro said his ill health was caused by overexerting himself during his travels last month. Raul Castro, who's 75, is Cuba's defense minister and first vice president. Under Cuba's constitution, he's first in line to take over from the president in case of incapacitating illness or death.
3 weeks before Monday's announcement, the U.S. Presidential Commission called for an $80 million program to support opponents of Castro. The funding has been billed as a democracy promotion. Critics say it will work to undermine Cuba's government the same way that U.S. democracy funding has destabilized regimes in other countries such as Haiti and Venezuela.
In a minute, we'll be speaking with Ricardo Alarcón, the president of the Cuban National Assembly. But first, we're going to go to an excerpt of the documentary Fidel, The Untold Story. It's directed by Estela Bravo, and it begins as Fidel Castro and his army enter Cuba in 1956 and start the two-year struggle to overthrow the Cuban dictator Batista. It features, among others, Cuban guerrilla commander Juan Almeida, Wayne Smith, the first head of the U.S. interest section since the U.S. has no embassy in Cuba, and Fidel's biographer Peter Bourne.
The grandma arrived 2 days later than expected, and the group landed in a mangrove swamp. The 82 men scattered, but were soon discovered by Batista's forces. Fidel and a few others escaped and refused to admit defeat. Of the original 82, only 21 managed to regroup in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. This is where the guerrilla war began, and the initial group was able to survive and grow. Che Guevara was the group's doctor.
The first commander Fidel appointed in the Sierra, with everybody in agreement, was Che. Fidel said, "He's well-trained and is the best strategist." That was Che. Later on, Raul and I, Camilo and the others, were also made commanders.
Much of their support came from the farmers in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. Some of them joined the guerrillas and became commanders. Both men and women soon joined Fidel's guerrilla movement. And despite traditional male prejudice, a women's battalion was formed.
One of the most important people in his life was a woman called Celia Sanchez. She was the daughter of a rural physician. Her father had provided free health care to many of the poor, impoverished rural people in the area. And she was very much attracted to Fidel's revolutionary movement.
Celia Sanchez remained at Fidel's side for 20 years and held important government posts until her death in 1980. Fidel and his commanders built up their 26th of July movement guerrilla army from a wide range of political allegiances. Batista's forces were trained by the United States, which also armed them with tanks, artillery, and aircraft. They threw all that force against the guerrillas in a war that lasted 2 years.
26th of July had a strong underground movement in the cities. There were sabotage efforts against the Batista government and demonstrations and so forth. The Batista government reacted very strongly. Bodies were left by the side of the road. Students, young people who were suspected of being rebel sympathizers were shot, or in some cases jailed and tortured. As a result of all that, public opinion turned massively against Batista.
An estimated 20,000 people were murdered by government forces during the Batista dictatorship. The rebels put out leaflets and a newspaper, and by 1958 also had a radio station keeping the people informed about developments. Fidel's interviews with foreign journalists ended rumors that he had been killed. Aware of the importance of the media, he made sure he was accessible to the press, even in English.
Our political philosophy is representative democracy and social justice in a well-planned economy.
Many of the things we've done have gone far beyond what we imagined at the time. Some of the things that have happened have proved more difficult than we'd imagined.
In January 1959, Fidel made a triumphal entry in Havana. It had taken 25 months to defeat Batista. With victory achieved, Fidel sought to make Cuba a united and independent nation.
An excerpt of the documentary Fidel, The Untold Story by Estela Bravo. We go now to Havana, Cuba, where we're joined on the line by the president of the Cuban National Assembly, Ricardo Alarcón. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, baby.
It's good to have you with us. First, how is President Fidel Castro's health? When did you last speak to him, and what is he talking about?
Well, I was with him. I met with him personally on Monday afternoon before the announcement was issued. And yesterday, on Tuesday, I was in communication with him also. I must say that he is perfectly conscious. He's a very good spirit, as always. We talked for over half an hour on many things, what's going on in the world, and so on. Yesterday, about the impact that the announcement has had. Of course, he is forced to have a period of rest. He underwent a complicated surgery, and he's in the I would say a normal period of recovery after an important surgery. That's essentially what I would say. But very alive and very alert as always, and interested in what's going on around him and around the world.
What is the surgery he underwent, and what is wrong with Fidel Castro?
Well, what is wrong with Fidel Castro is that he really works a lot. He has been working his entire life. He's not a head of state that is available only for a few photo opportunities and some ceremonies and so. He really take his responsibilities and his duties as a mission. That's why he, apart from being substituted provisionally according to the constitution as the head of state, as head of the party, and so on, he also had to designate certain comrades for specific programs on the healthcare area, on education, on energy, and so on, programs that he was conducting personally. He is a very rare head of state. He's a head of state that works, and works very, very much. And of course, if you travel, you go to the Eastern Cuba and make two speeches in the same day and have many meetings and so on, when notwithstanding his very healthy reality, things happen, and at some point he suffered a sort of a crisis that probably was motivated by the stress and the excess. Excessive effort that his body was making, and that's it. But notwithstanding all that, I would say that he is doing fairly well. It's a serious matter, of course. I do not want to diminish the complexity of the situation, because always surgery. Intestinal surgery, as any doctor could tell you, is a serious matter, and the recovery process is also some period of care, he needs a lot of attention and care, and that is why he cannot be at the same time holding certain responsibilities, because I repeat, it, for him, that is not a photo op. It's a matter of hours and hours dedicated to healthcare programs, to education, to energy saving programs, and so on and so forth.
Ricardo Alarcón, as you say, President Castro is legendary for the long hours that he keeps. And the two opportunities over the years that I've had to interview him, both of the interviews didn't start until about 1 o'clock in the morning and went on for several hours. But here in the United States, the commercial press and in Washington, they're trying to make much of the fact that he has not been seen or that he did not make the announcement himself. Your reaction to some of the speculation here that he is even much sicker than the government is letting out?
I think that the letter or the announcement that he wrote himself with his hands, the decisions that are in that document reflects a person that is very much aware of what is going on and capable of taking decisions immediately after having been obliged to undergo a complicated surgical operation. Of course, he is not a young fellow. He is 79 years old. But listen, I have seen some not only the speculation, but some very shameful manifestations of people. Like some people appear to enjoy a human being physical sufferings or risks, and that reminds me, we're now beginning August. A few weeks ago was the anniversary of the commencement of the Spanish Civil War. There was a general, notorious Franco general, who became famous for an infamous face. Remember what he said: long live death. You see, some groups in Miami, some federal Congress people, some spokesmen from the U.S. government, like enjoying the idea of this man being ill or even longing of his death, and even invented it. And they have spent years speculating, attributing to him diseases one after the other and so on. The facts are reflected, announced publicly by him himself, and he said the truth. And unfortunately for those people, I can tell you, I would repeat, I met with him personally, who spent half an hour not just talking about the document, talking about Lebanon, talking about the U.S., talking about the situation in the world. And he was very alert, as always. We were exchanging some jokes. And yesterday, again, we communicated. And those are the facts. Of course, I communicated, I saw him, but he is resting, physically resting. He has to do that.
Ricardo Alarcón, we're going to break for 60 seconds with music, and then we're going to come back to you. We'd like to play for you the response of the White House, the White House spokesperson, Tony Snow, what he had to say. We would also like to ask you about what President Fidel Castro had to say about Lebanon and the United States as he recovers from his surgery. We're speaking with Ricardo Alarcón, president of the Cuban National Assembly. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Decirte ni sé explicarme qué pasó, pero de ti me enamoré. Fue una luz que iluminó todo mi ser, tu risa como lleno mi vida de inquietud. Fueron tus ojos o tu boca, fueron tus labios o tu voz.
Ibrahim Ferrer here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking with the president of the Cuban National Assembly. We're talking to Ricardo Alarcón. He is in Havana right now, has already met with the Cuban president, Fidel Castro, after surgery, and has spoken with him yesterday as well. I wanted to get your response, Ricardo Alarcón, to White House spokesperson Tony Snow, who yesterday dismissed Raul Castro's leadership and said the U.S. government will not be reaching out to him.
The one thing that this president has talked about from the very beginning is his hope for the Cuban people finally to enjoy the fruits of freedom and democracy, and for the dictator, Fidel Castro, to hand off power to his brother who's been the prison keeper is not a change in that status. So Raul Castro's attempt to impose himself on the Cuban people is much the same as what his brother did. So, no, there are no plans to reach out. The one thing we want to do is continue to assure the people of Cuba that we stand ready to help.
That's Tony Snow, White House spokesperson. Your response, Ricardo Alarcón.
Well, let me tell you that the disappearance or a change of personalities in the Cuban government, which is a matter exclusively that belongs to us, we are an independent country, has become a very serious security issue for us. Remember that the U.S. government in the year 2004 approved a program that President Bush said that was going to be seriously implemented to not to permit precisely that the 10th, President Bush approved the last report of a so-called commission to assist Free Cuba. That means a clear plan of intervention in another country. And this program, this last report, it begins with a chapter with the title Hastening the End of the Castro Regime. It's not something waiting for to help, quote-unquote, the Cuban people in the future. It's a plan to hasten the end of our government, and begins with a phrase that should concern Americans a lot, saying that that report is just the unclassified part of something else. They said that they have additional measures that remain classified, in other words, secret. What means that? Are they going to announce, or are they announcing a new military adventure abroad? Are Americans really prepared to, after having gone to war in Iraq, out of lies and distortion by all those same Fox people like Mr. Snow, are they prepared now to go to another war just because Mr. Snow or Mr. Bush do not like the kind of government that we have down here in Cuba? I don't like the U.S. government, to be very frank, but that doesn't give me any right to have plans, secret or otherwise, to change the way the American system operates. I think that's a very dangerous approach. That's why we said that in our communique. Fidel repeated that yesterday, by the way, in a second letter that was made public here in Cuba, that this issue, this matter, that should be very, in a way, legally speaking, technically speaking, a rather simple matter, the substitution of the president by the vice president and so on and so forth, according to the constitution and the laws of a particular country. And it's an imperial approach that I think is a little bit outdated. The U.S. at this moment is not prepared, really, seriously, to entertain more wars and so on and so forth. That's why they have issued on July the 10th this last report, but the most important part of it remains secret. For our part, of course, we will do our best to defeat all those plans, those announced and those that remain a secret. We have a long experience in fighting and resisting U.S. attempts to undermine our independence and to defeat our sovereignty.
Ricardo Alarcón, you mentioned that in your discussions with President Castro after his surgery, that you discussed to some extent the situation in Lebanon. Could you share with us some of his thoughts about that, and also how the Cuban government is viewing the situation, the escalating battles going on in the Middle East right now?
Well, we are really very, very concerned about the situation. We have condemned the violation of Lebanese sovereignty and the attacks on Lebanon or the attacks on Gaza, and we are concerned that the situation, as it appears, is leading towards an enlargement, an extension of the war. The last news I saw, the Israeli troops may be approaching the Syrian border. It's something that should provoke some international action to stop that. I think that we believe strongly that the very first issue, we agree with that, on that with the Lebanese government, is to stop the fighting immediately. Many people are dying on both sides, mostly civilians, and that's the result of a senseless policy of violence and aggression that must be ended right away.
Does Cuba, does the president, does Fidel Castro have a relationship with either the Iranian leadership or the Syrian leadership? And before his illness, was he communicating with them, if he does?
Well, we have, it's not a secret, we have a very friendly relation with both Syria and Iran, also with the Lebanese Republic. As a matter of fact, part of our population comes from that background, the Lebanese, Christian Lebanese that emigrated to this part of the world. That's why it's an issue that touched us very directly, I would say. And we understand that they are also concerned, and they are, as many people around the world. Remember that if we don't have yet a ceasefire, it's only because of the U.S. and Israeli opposition. Even Europe, practically everybody has been demanding for that. But you have, again, the U.N. Security Council paralyzed due to the successful efforts of Mr. Bolton and the U.S. Delegation.
I'd like to ask you, in terms of this, of the current situation in Latin America, obviously a lot has changed, you know, over the years as U.S. administrations have continued to support the embargo or to lead their sole embargo against Cuba in Latin America. And do you think that in the current climate of the more popular governments that have come to power in many countries in Latin America, that the United States would dare to try to intervene directly in Cuba?
I think that at this moment, in the current administration that you are enjoying from Washington, there are people that are thinking if they could, they would even intervene militarily. That's why they went that far in the 2004 program adopted by Mr. Bush and in the last report. The problem is that I do not see how could anybody rationally in the U.S. consider the possibility of promoting or provoking another war. I don't think that idea would be very popular among Americans at this particular moment. They are not really enjoying a very easy situation in Iraq, as they thought was the case when they began that intervention. That's why the previous report was more openly aggressive. Now they have to reserve those areas to the secret plans. But let me tell you that in this last report, they recognized how Cuba has advanced and at the same time reflects a desperate effort to reinforce that embargo, notwithstanding the reality that nobody else is supporting it. For example, now, according to what Mr. Bush decided on July the 10th, no humanitarian items could come from U.S. churches to the Cuban National Council of Churches, that includes the Jewish community. They have been receiving traditionally support for their rights and their activities, the evangelicals, the Protestants, the Anglican Church, and the Jewish community from their U.S. counterparts. Now they cannot anymore. They are threatening to criminalize violations of the travel ban to Cuba. They are, in this last report, trying or threatening to undermine what they refer to as large-scale health care programs for foreigners in Cuba and elsewhere. What means that? That they have to recognize that at this moment, millions of people, Gonzalez, had received healthcare, free health care here in Cuba or in Venezuela. or are receiving it in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Guatemala, all over the world, that there are 30,000 Cuban doctors abroad helping people to recover vision, to fight illness and so on. They recognize that, and they said that they will not permit exports of equipment that may help those programs. All of that is in that report that unfortunately has not been noticed in some US media, that you keep talking about a so-called aid program for Cuba after the Castro regime doesn't exist anymore, and blah 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 blah. In other words, you have a very peculiar administration in your country. People that do not accept reality and imagine that they can ignore reality and change it. Reality is that Fidel Castro was down there in Cordoba, in Argentina. Why? Because we were invited. Because Cuba has established an association with Mercosur. But he was together with a large number of head of governments in South America, of the whole Mercosur group, and Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, who was attended. And they condemned, of course, the embargo again, and not just in words, but in action that are reflected in the strengthening of our economic and others links with them. By the way, since Monday, we have received messages from practically every government in Latin America expressing their concern and their solidarity with President Fidel Castro in his current situation, including a very beautiful message by President Lula that Cubans know, because it was published here yesterday. I don't know if you know that in New York, but I think that one has to be absolutely out of his mind to believe that policy functions, that policy works. The world and the reality around the U.S. is showing that it is not the case. But even in America, even in the U.S., you have people that would like very much to expand trade with Cuba, to have more normal relations, or to just to travel, to exercise that right, that now maybe even leading some people to a court to be accused, indicted of that serious crime. By the way, I hope you're aware, Juan, that they arrested a number of Puerto Ricans when they arrived in Mayagüez a few days ago. The crime, having come to Cuba, now is a more serious crime, according to Mr.
No, I was not aware of those latest arrests. And thank you for informing me about that.
They traveled to Cuba via Dominican Republic, and apparently they went by boat from Eastern Dominican to Mayagüez, in the west part of Puerto Rico, and upon arrival there, they were. It's not exactly. They don't say that they are detained in a formal way, but they were detained. Upon arrival, they are being interviewed and so on, and they were notified that they did violate American law, and now, since July the 10th, they may be indicted and incarcerated, which is something that is crazy. It's easier to do that in Mayagüez because nobody would notice in elsewhere, they hope.
Ricardo Alarcón, we only have 30 seconds, and we're going to be going to Beirut in a moment. But I wanted to ask about your comments quoted in Prensa Latina, calling the president, President Bush, a terrorist for what's happening in Lebanon right now. It was part of your condemnation of what you called the Israeli massacre in Cana.
Not only because I visited Cana, I felt very moved to conceive that, again, the same story was repeated. But President Bush is a terrorist. His policy is terrorist. He was meeting last Monday in Miami with some very well-known terrorists. This Monday, 48 hours ago, he kept five young Cubans in detention, incarcerated. Next week, on August the 9th, will be 1 year after the Court of Appeals revoke the convictions of those people, but they remain in prison. And at the same time, you can watch on Miami TV or read in the Miami press how terrorist activities continue to be prepared, announced openly.
Who did President Bush meet with in Miami?
Which, sorry?
You said that President Bush met with terrorists in Miami when he was just there this week.
Ninoska Perez Castellón, Armando Perez Roura, they had breakfast on Monday, and he was on the air interviewing some of the most radical pro-terrorist programs in Miami.
And why do you call them terrorists?
Monday.
And why do you call them terrorists?
Because they are terrorists, because these people belong to groups that openly proclaim that they have. Have you heard about Mr. Llama? He was on Miami TV claiming that he had spent $1.4 million to buy weapons, including small light planes that can be teledirected for terrorist purposes. He said that in Miami, the same day that in Miami, half a dozen black people were arrested on the accusation that they were going to blow up the Sears Towers. And so this very same day, a guy, of course, a white millionaire, appeared on TV saying that. And then you have your president coming down there to have a meeting. Was a funding operation that he had, a fundraising operation on Sunday and Monday. And I know, because that was published, that he had breakfast with some of them, Ninoska Perez Castellón, a former leader of the Cuban American National Foundation, leader now of the so-called Cuban Liberty Council that advocates openly military actions against Cuba, Armando Perez Roura.
Ricardo Alarcón.
Who has a daily program in the same view.
We're going to have to leave it there. We want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back from break, we're going to briefly speak with Leonard Weinglass, attorney for the Cuban Five, to find out the latest. And then we'll go to Beirut and speak with Mohamed Bassi, who is with Newsday and was born in Lebanon. Stay with us. Prado here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Before we head to Beirut, very briefly, we're joined in the studio by Leonard Weinglass, who is a civil rights attorney and one of the lawyers for the Cuban Five, who Ricardo Alarcón, the president of the National Assembly, just referred to. Explain, what is their situation today?
Well, they remain in prison despite the fact that 1 year ago, a circuit court of the 11th Circuit ruled that they should be their conviction should be set aside. But the government, in an extraordinary move, appealed that decision to the full court. We re-argued their case on February 14th. We're now waiting for a new decision.
And they are who?
The five are five men who came to the United States, to Miami, from Cuba, in order to monitor the activities of terror groups that had inflicted life loss, property loss on Cuba over the last 10 years in the 90s. And they were not seeking any military secrets in the United States, but they were arrested and convicted of espionage.
And in terms of the length of time that it's taken on the appeal process, is this a normal or has this been an extended period?
Well, they've served so far 8 years in prison. As they sit now in prison, they are presumed innocent, and we're waiting for the final decision. But their situation is unique and unusual. Cubans have been treated differently in this, our system of justice, as a result of what you've seen in the last 48 hours in Miami. This is a very hostile atmosphere. It's a place where they never should have been tried, so found by the court. And so we're hoping that this will be rectified and that they'll be sent home.
Well, Leonard Weinglass, the anniversary of the court decision is August 9th, and we're going to continue to have this discussion about the Cuban Five. I want to thank you very much for being with us. As we turn now to the situation in Beirut, Israel sent as many as 18,000 troops into Lebanon as part of a massive ground invasion, the ground assault coming as Israel continues to bomb areas around South Lebanon. A Lebanese official said Israel is carrying out an unprecedented air attack on the ancient city of Baalbek, the assault beginning late Tuesday, 3 hours before the end of Israel's announced two-day pause to the bombing. We're going to turn now to our guest, Mohammed Bassi, who is in Beirut and has been covering the situation there. In fact, was born in Beirut, Middle East bureau chief for Newsday, has been based in Beirut for 3 years. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you start off by just describing the situation and the latest piece that you've written?
Well, today there's more bombing in the south, both airstrikes and artillery bombing in various villages. There's some bombing around the city of Tyre in the south, which is the largest city in the south. There is also Hezbollah has fired. There's an estimate of 200. To 300 rockets today, and there's a I'm sorry, I'm hearing several other people on the line.
We are not hearing anyone else on the line, so if you could just bear with it, hearing the voices and talking to us, your line is very clear.
Okay. Anyway, there's also about 200 to 300 rockets that were fired by Hezbollah on northern Israel today. There's so that brings up the question of Israel saying it's diminished Hezbollah's rocket and missile capability anywhere from by half or a third. Today they've actually fired, they've been able to fire more rockets and missiles than any other day since this war began. There's a lot of concern about the Israeli activity in the city of Baalbek, which is in the Bekaa Valley. There was a raid by Israeli commandos on a hospital there. Three Lebanese were kidnapped from this hospital. Israel says they were Hezbollah commanders. Hezbollah denies that that the three people had anything to do with Hezbollah. And there's more bombing around Baalbek and the surrounding villages.
In your articles in Newsday, some of them you have mentioned the possible or the almost certain radicalization of a whole new generation of people in the Middle East as a result of this attack. Could you talk about that?
Yes, there's, in one of my articles, I talked about Osama bin Laden in a videotape in October 2004, a few days before the U.S. presidential election. Sent a tape to Al Jazeera in which he, for the first time, he claimed responsibility for ordering the September 11th attacks. And for the first time, he gave an explanation of why he did it, and it was a pretty remarkable explanation. He said that he was motivated by the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And he had this remarkable quote where he said something like, "When I saw the towers burning in Beirut, it sparked in my mind the idea that sort of that the aggressors have to be punished in the same way, and we must attack towers in America." This tape has gotten very little attention in the last few weeks. Some of the images that Bin Laden talked about in those tapes are things very similar to what's happening now. Ayman al-Zawahiri, his deputy, put out a videotape about a week ago, which he called on Muslims all over the world to join the fight in Lebanon and Gaza. And then the scenes from Khana over the weekend, sort of 10 years later in Khana, are just generating tremendous anger in the Arab world. It's also important to note that Bin Laden has mentioned Khana several times. He actually mentioned Khana in 1996 in his first fatwa against the United States. He had a line talking about the images of women and children being pulled from the rubble in that attack on the UN compound in Khana. And he mentioned it several other interviews after that. So it was definitely something on his mind and that motivated him.
Mohammed Bassi, what happened during the what was called the 48-hour ceasefire around the Israeli airstrikes? What actually took place in that period?
It was supposed to be Israel said it would cease aerial strikes in Lebanon. It actually did not. There were fewer air attacks than there were in previous days. But even from the very first day, there was fighting in some villages with Hezbollah. One of the villages was Srifa. There was the village of Ait Ashab. These are villages fairly close to the border. And there were pretty intense airstrikes on those villages. And then there was, on Tuesday, the second day of this 48-hour break, there was more airstrikes in different parts of the south. There were airstrikes on Baalbek late last night, Tuesday night. And all through this time, there were Israeli troops entering the south, thousands of troops, as you mentioned, entering different villages, going in and out of Lebanon, hundreds of tanks and armored vehicles also going in to various villages.
Mohammed Bassi, I want to thank you for joining us. I'm sorry we've come to the end of our program. Mohammed Bassi is Middle East bureau chief for Newsday, has been based in Beirut for the past 3 years, was actually born in Beirut. This is Democracy Now!, and we've come to the end of the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aaron Mate, and Frank Lopez, Mike DeFilippo, Nuck Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg Peshkin, Louie Abu Aspa, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Uri Galad, Angela Alston, Megan Whitney, and Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.